and welcome to Clerkship Ready Pediatrics, a podcast aimed at helping you excel during your clinical clerkship in pediatrics. I am Shakun Gupta, a general pediatrician, an associate professor of pediatrics, and the associate clerkship director at the University of Virginia. During your pediatrics clerkship, you will likely spend some time in the newborn nursery. You may also spend some time in a transitional nursery or a neonatal ICU, but today's podcast is focused specifically on helping you feel prepared to see babies in the newborn nursery on day one. The birth of a child is a major event in a family, so be cognizant that parents are often overwhelmed, exhausted, and adjusting to a rapid change in their lives. This might mean letting them sleep if they are resting on rounds and giving information and tidbits throughout the admission and throughout the day. The newborn nursery service usually consists of a team of healthcare providers made up of an attending, some residents, third-year medical students. You may also work with a fourth-year medical student and/or a nurse practitioner. Because nurseries are typically high volume and quick turnaround services, there is a lot that has to happen in a short period of time after a baby is born until they are discharged. In the U.S., legislation allows for up to 48 hours of a hospital stay for a vaginal delivery and up to 96 hours after birth via cesarean. Discharge prior to this may be considered as long as the goals of care for mom and baby or the dyad are being met. Some dyads require longer admissions, but every attempt is made to discharge both together with rooming in throughout the hospital stay as much as possible. Due to this high turnover, there can be a fair amount of repetition in the work you will do in the nursery. This is a great opportunity to practice lots of newborn exams, get comfortable talking with families about common baby care education, and hopefully attend some deliveries. The goal of the newborn nursery is to prepare families for how to care for their new baby, as well as ensure that any abnormality or concern for the baby is identified early and follow-up is planned. Most babies will follow up with an outpatient pediatrician within just a few days of being discharged from the nursery, and usually within 1 to 2 days if they're discharged before 48 hours of life. Some general tips for success on this rotation are, since newborns are admitted and discharged rapidly, plan to check in with your supervising attending or resident each morning to determine which patients you'll be following, and make sure to check in with your team about the best note templates to use. This will help remind you of which data to collect on each baby. You'll also want to get familiar with the electronic medical record and how you can easily find the information in both the baby's and mother's chart. Although you are not caring for the mother while in the newborn nursery, there's a lot of information you will need to gather about her pregnancy and delivery that will be found in her medical record. Let's start by reviewing the information you will need to gather on the mother and baby immediately after birth for your admission. First, for baby's information, start with finding out the baby's gestational age. This is the common term for the number of weeks old the baby is at birth. The pregnancy is often dated from the mother's first day of her last menstrual period as the time of conception, and the gestational age is confirmed with an ultrasound, ideally in the first trimester of pregnancy. Ultrasounds in the first trimester are very accurate, and there is usually not much discrepancy in the dating. If a mother did not have this accurate dating of her pregnancy, you may end up using a specific checklist examination done after birth called the Ballard or Dubovitz score, which looks at neuromuscular and physical maturity rating parameters to determine the gestational age after birth. Babies born between 34 weeks and 0 days to 36 weeks and 6 days are considered late preterm infants. Early-term babies are those born between 37 and 0 days to 38 weeks and 6 days, and full-term is 39 weeks and 0 days to 40 weeks and 6 days. Babies born after 41 weeks and 0 days are considered late-term, and those born after 41 weeks and 6 days are considered post-term. These are important distinctions because late preterm and early term babies are at higher risk for certain morbidities in the newborn period, such as hypoglycemia, jaundice, respiratory distress, and temperature instability. Next, for mother's information, you will start by finding out her age and her G's and P's. G is for gestation, the number of pregnancies the mother has had in the past. P is for partum, which is the number of deliveries the mother has had. To further break down the numbers in P, the four numbers are term, preterm, aborted, and live, or TPAL. Next, you will want to know the mode of delivery or how the baby was delivered, whether a vaginal or a cesarean section. if a C-section, find out why it was done. Was it because the mother had one before, in that case, a repeat C-section, or because there was distress for the baby requiring an emergent procedure, such as decelerations or fetal tachycardia or bradycardia, or due to baby positioning, such as being breech? Other reasons there might have been a C-section is if there was failure of labor progression or failure to descend. It is not the usual expected course frequently, so dig around as to why. Your first line of your presentation will often sound something like this. This is a 4-hour-old boy born at 38 and 5 weeks gestation via spontaneous vaginal delivery to a 35-year-old G2, now P2002 mother with diabetes managed on insulin. Now get some prenatal history from mother's chart. You will want to know if mother had early and regular prenatal care. If there was late initiation of prenatal care or limited or lack of prenatal care, this might indicate a social barrier to care, such as transportation, that needs to be addressed during this hospitalization. You will find out if her ultrasounds during the pregnancy were normal and with normal amniotic fluid volume, which may indicate medical issues in the baby. Along with this, at 20 weeks, mothers get a detailed anatomy ultrasound, and you need to know if any abnormalities were suspected or found on this scan. In the first trimester of pregnancy, mothers have a panel of prenatal labs done. This consists of the following: maternal blood type. If a mother is Rh negative blood type, there is a possibility of Rh incompatibility with the baby's blood type. Similarly, if mother is blood type O and the baby is A or B, the baby is at risk for hemolytic disease or ABO incompatibility. Mothers also get tested for infectious serologies, HIV, hepatitis B, and syphilis antibodies. These change immediate newborn management and must be known. Other tests are rubella and varicella antibody, which tell us about previous immunization in mother, as these can cause serious congenital birth defects. Mothers may also be tested for gonorrhea, chlamydia, hepatitis C, and urine drug screen. Between 36 and 38 weeks, mothers get a rectal vaginal swab for group B strep bacteria, which is a major cause of neonatal sepsis, morbidity, and mortality. If a mother is GBS positive, we will want to know if she received GBS-specific antibiotics during labor at least 2 or 4 hours prior to delivery, as this decreases risk to the baby. GBS-specific antibiotics are penicillin or ampicillin. Mothers are also tested via a glucose tolerance test for gestational diabetes. Next, you will want to look at the mother's maternal medical conditions, as there are several that can have important consequences for the baby. Make sure to know if mother was on any medications, prescribed or not, during pregnancy besides prenatal vitamins and why. Some common examples are maternal diabetes, which can cause low blood sugar or hypoglycemia in the baby. Maternal hypertension, which could cause a small for gestational size baby. Maternal substance use disorder, which can cause neonatal abstinence syndrome in the baby. Maternal autoimmune illness, and many others. You get the point that maternal illness or maternal chronic conditions can cause issues in the baby, so you'll want to know. For delivery information, you will want to know if any resuscitation was done on the baby at the time of delivery. There may have been a nurse in the room who took care of the baby immediately after the delivery, or a pediatric team may have been present if any complication was expected. Reasons to have a pediatric team present vary by hospital, but some common reasons may be a baby that is late preterm, if a baby passed meconium in the amniotic fluid during labor and delivery, if a change in baby's vital signs was observed during labor, or if mother gets a fever during labor. If a baby is born vigorous and crying, they're placed on mother's chest for skin-to-skin contact, which helps baby stabilize their temperature quickly and are typically not disturbed for an hour. 95 to 98% of babies will have no resuscitation required. Other resuscitation efforts may include suctioning the mouth of the baby with a bulb syringe and stimulating the baby by rubbing the back to elicit a strong cry. If baby starts crying, they can then be given to the parent. If not, resuscitation may progress to oxygen, CPAP, or positive pressure ventilation. You will also want to know the Apgar score assignment. This is a standardized way to communicate the clinical status of a newborn infant. The score traditionally is assigned at 1 and 5 minutes of life, but may be continued every 5 minutes as dictated by the clinical context. The score has 5 components: heart rate, respiratory effort, muscle tone, reflex irritability, and color. Each component is given a score of 0, 1, or 2. a 5-minute Apgar score of 7 to 10 is considered normal. Now looking at the actual baby in front of you, you will need to know the growth parameters for the baby. Newborns who fall outside of the normal growth percentile ranges qualify as small for gestational age, less than 10th percentile, and large for gestational age, more than 90th percentile. The Fenton charts are an example of growth charts that evaluate growth according to gestational age and are commonly used in the newborn nursery. Size for gestational age is a weight issue. Length and head circumference help us better define SGA, symmetric or asymmetric, but micro and macrocephaly are better descriptors for head size, and a long baby is not necessarily LGA. The infant who is small for weight but has preserved head size or asymmetric frequently has experienced poor growth because of placental insufficiency. The infant who is symmetrically small is more likely to have been affected by an environmental factor such as smoking or other toxin, a genetic factor, or a congenital infection like CMV. LGA can be associated with diabetes, excess maternal weight gain, or genetic syndromes. Now let's focus on the newborn exam, since this is a very unique part of your pediatrics experience. It's important to do a daily thorough exam in the nursery, as this is the first time an exam has ever been done by a healthcare provider on this patient, and you may catch abnormalities early. Newborn vital signs are different than other children and other adults. The temperature range is 36.5 Celsius to 37.9 Celsius. Rectal temperatures are the most accurate in newborns, but your nursery may monitor every 4 to 8 hours with an axillary temperature. The normal heart rate range is 120 to 160 beats per minute. A normal newborn respiratory rate is 35 to 60 breaths per minute. And oxygen saturations are the same for other children and adults, with normal range being above 90 in room air. For your general part of the exam, make note of the appropriate size of the baby, the level of distress of the baby, and the ability to calm if the baby is fussy or crying. For your HEENT exam, note the size and any shaping abnormalities. The anterior and posterior fontanelle should be felt and check for overriding suture lines. It is also important to check for bruising on the scalp and other things like a caput succinatum or a cephalohematoma. We'll check a red reflex on the baby every day. It's important to note whether there's any scleral icterus to help assess for hyperbilirubinemia. And if the baby is just born, make note whether you see erythromycin ointment applied. For your respiratory exam, it's very important to assess for respiratory distress, so make note of retractions, grunting, tachypnea if present. Newborns often do periodic breathing, meaning they'll take a few fast breaths and slow down. So if you're worried, take a count for a full 60 seconds to get an accurate sense. For your cardiovascular exam, it can be very difficult to hear murmurs in the newborn due to their fast heart rates, so take your time. Remember to check for capillary refill. Normal is less than 3 seconds, but in babies' feet, they can often have a prolonged cap refill of 4 to 5 seconds due to something called acrocyanosis, and to check for femoral pulse. If you're having a hard time finding the femoral pulse, try adding more surface pressure with another finger or changing the pressure that you're assessing with. For abdominal exam, as with any other abdominal exam, check for masses or distension. One key thing to remember is that we are the first doctors to examine this patient, so we need to check for things like a patent anus that other doctors will take for granted for the rest of this child's life. For males, it's important to note that testicles are present and palpable bilaterally. If they aren't, make a specific note, and the child will need repeat exams at their outpatient pediatrician's office. If they have not descended by 6 months, the child will need a referral to a urologist. You'll also want to ask the family if they would like a circumcision during their baby's admission. For females, make note of whether the anatomy appears normal and whether there's any vaginal discharge. Vaginal discharge is often present and can be normal. A small amount of white or blood-tinged discharge is due to withdrawal of maternal estrogen. For your musculoskeletal exam, check the clavicles for crepitus, a sign that there may have been a fracture. Also make sure that you check the hips for laxity using the Ortolani and Barlow maneuver. This maneuver is hard to describe, so I would recommend that you find a YouTube video to show you. For skin, check for nevus simplex on the forehead an angel's kiss or the back of the neck, a stork bite. Also make note of a congenital dermal melanocytosis, often a blue-gray spot on the lower back. You'll want to check the back to see if there's any sacral dimples or tufts of hair, which would be concerning for an occult spinal dysraphism. For your neurological exam, you'll want to assess tone by gently pulling the extremities away from the body and watching for flexion. There are many reflexes that are also unique to the newborn. The rooting reflex is when you put a finger near the mouth of the child to watch for attempts to suck. The Moro reflex is also called the startle reflex, is when you gently lift the arms of the baby up and drop them, looking for an outstretched arm and hand response. The Babinski reflex is the opposite of expectations in newborn. Since the upper motor neurons are not quite developed, you're looking for upgoing toes on your Babinski. During the baby's admission in the hospital, you and the nursing staff will monitor and report several things simultaneously. One of these will be input or feedings, whether number of breastfeeds and quality of breastfeeds, or timing and volume of formula feeds. Another will be output. The first stool in a baby is thick, black, tarry, and sticky. It's often passed in the first 24 to 48 hours of life. Delayed passage of this first stool can be associated with several conditions, including imperforate anus, Hirschsprung, small left colon, meconium plug syndrome, meconium ileus, and other forms of colonic obstruction. Infants may require investigation with imaging such as a barium enema or rectal suction biopsy. Following passage of this meconium, stools transition from green-brown to yellow seedy over the next few days and can be passed as frequently as after every feed. The first void should also occur in the first 24 hours, but may be easily missed in diapers with meconium or not documented in the delivery room. Quality of feeding should be assessed, and renal anomalies as well as urinary obstruction should be considered. It is sometimes helpful to place a cotton ball or bag over the genitalia to increase the ability to observe a void in those infants who have not voided in the first 24 hours of life. As a rule of thumb, infants should void twice on their second day of life, three times on their third day of life, etc., up to a minimum of about 5 to 6 voids per day. Urate crystals or brick dust and vaginal white discharge and even vaginal spotting and bleeding are sometimes mistaken as hematuria, but are normal in newborn babies in the first couple days of life. Babies will get several routine screening exams during their admission to the newborn nursery. The first of these is a hearing test for hearing loss universally screened before discharge home with one of two types of newborn hearing tests depending on your hospital. The AAP recommends all babies get a critical congenital heart disease screen, commonly called the CCHD, at 24 hours of life or later, which includes a bedside pulse oximetry simultaneously placed on a preductal and postductal extremity to monitor for low blood oxygen levels, or a large difference in the two that could pick up a congenital heart lesion. A screening jaundice level should be done on all babies prior to discharge home. This is typically done with a transcutaneous bilirubin monitor, which is a non-invasive method and works by measuring serum bilirubin level by directing light into the skin and measuring the intensity of the wavelength of light that is returned. At 24 hours or later, a newborn screen will be collected on the baby via a heel stick. This is slightly different in each state, but consists of conditions that are rare but important to identify early, such as metabolic disorders, hemoglobin disorders, and endocrine disorders. If not done shortly after birth, babies should also, before discharge, have one intramuscular injection of vitamin K, which provides clotting factors that babies are not born with enough of, the first dose of hepatitis B vaccine to prevent vertical transmission or exposure to Hep B, and erythromycin eye ointment to prevent certain types of neonatal conjunctivitis caused by gonorrhea and chlamydia that could lead to blindness. There's a lot of information given to the parents before discharging a baby home. The AAP recommends talking to all families about safe sleep procedures, prevention of shaken baby syndrome, the recognition of maternal postnatal mood disorder, which is still commonly referred to as postpartum depression and is quite common. You will also want to educate on signs of illness in babies and cord, skin, circumcision, site care, all prior to discharge. Once this education is complete, there's been stable vital signs for 12 to 24 hours, at least 2 consecutive successful feeds without excessive weight loss, passage of urine and stool, and completion of all the newborn care tasks we discussed, the diet is ready for discharge home with a follow-up appointment in place. the newborn nursery is a great time to practice your newborn exams and be a special part of a family's journey. I sincerely hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening to Clerkship Ready Pediatrics. Hope you found today's podcast helpful. Don't forget to subscribe below and rate the podcast.